All right, this morning we have between our two principal speakers, I don't know if they want me to say this or not, but probably a century of experience, not each, in combination. Our speakers this morning are two of the leading and certainly most famous and accomplished members of ARSC, I think, and it's a real pleasure to have them here. They're not able to be at every year's conference, and they were graciously able to come to this year's. Our first speaker is Dan Morgenstern, who is the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. He's one of the best-known jazz commentators, I think, in the country, frequently quoted. He's the winner of, it's now up to eight, right? Eight Grammy Awards for his liner notes, most recently for the mosaic set of the complete Louis Armstrong Decas. I get that right? He's going to speak this morning, as a matter of fact, on some very interesting aspects of Louis Armstrong and his career, which have only recently been unearthed and brought to light and distributed through the work of Dan. So I give you Dan Morgenstern.
Thank you, Tim, and it's a great pleasure to be here. On my tag, which I'm not wearing, it says that it's the first time for me at an ARSC, which is not true. My first one was sometime in the 80s, I think, but I've been away for a long time. Let me first explain who is sitting next to me here. In my opinion, one of the greatest recording and restoration engineers, Doug Pomeroy. I'd asked Doug to join me because he is responsible for the excellent sound of the restored Fleischmann's yeast lacquers, I guess you would call them, which were discovered at Louis Armstrong's house by me. It's not very modest of me to claim that, but I'll explain a little bit how that happened. Anyway, how many of you are familiar with the Fleischmann's yeast shows? Not many, which is what I had feared and maybe hoped, too, because if you all knew about it, why should I be here and tell you? So anyway, my jazz mentor was a little trumpet player. Nobody knows anything about him except musicians. He never recorded. His name was Nat Lorber. He was actually born in Harlem before that became a primarily black neighborhood in New York. Raised in the Bronx and Brooklyn, so he knew all of greater New York like the back of his hand. He was liked and sponsored by a number of musicians. Hot Lips Page, the great trumpet player, who was from Texas, called him Shouty, which was for shorty, in his Texas accent, because he was a little shorter than Lips, who wasn't very tall. Roy Eldridge, who was known as Little Jazz, wasn't very tall either, and he called Nat Space Cadet. He was a favorite of many great jazz musicians, but not known by critics, and he was an underground figure. Anyway, Nat is the one who first told me about Louis Armstrong and the Fleischmann's yeast shows. He said, he would have been about 17 at the time. He was born in 1920. He said, in 1937, there was this radio show of the Fleischmann's yeast, and man, Pops was playing like, He said he especially remembered Louis doing something with the Mills Brothers on Sweet Georgia Brown. Unfortunately, that has not survived. But the Fleischmann's Yeast and Louis sort of stayed in my memory. And when the Louis Armstrong Educational Foundation decided to give Queens College in New York a charge of the Armstrong House and its contents, subsequently the Armstrong House also was joined by the Armstrong Archives, which are now housed in Queens College Library. And the house, of course, has been beautifully restored. Any of you visited the house when you were in New York? You should all make a point of, if you come to New York, go out to Queens and visit us. It's a marvelous experience. Michael Cogswell, who is in charge of that, has done a tremendous job making things look and feel just like when Louis was alive. In any event, once this Queens College charge came about, a music professor at Queens, who also happened to be an ex-jazz trumpet player and quite a good one, his name was Howard Brofsky, decided to invite a number of, not a great number, but a few people who he thought would be helpful in looking over what was in the house and giving some advice to the college. George Avakian was one, Frank Driggs was another, and I was the third. Now, I had the good fortune, one of the biggest things in my life, and not only in my jazz life, was that I had the good fortune of getting to know Louis Armstrong. I first met him backstage at the Roxy Theater in New York in 1949, and I had not infrequently visited Louis at his house, so I was somewhat familiar with the surroundings. Louis had a good-sized record collection. Anyway, the point of all this was that I thought maybe, just maybe, these Fleischmann things, there might be something there. So I started looking through the records, and there's a lot of stuff, fascinating because it was such a great variety of materials. And I had just about given up hope when I came across a 12-inch, 78 RPM lacquer with a label. I think the label was, they were sort of buff colored, right? And it said Fleischmann. Ah, okay. So there was a bunch of these. I told Professor Brofsky right away, you know, put these away. Don't let anybody touch them. Don't let anybody play them. Only professional recording engineers should have access to this, because this is something really, you know, absolutely essential. So in any case, it took a long time before the Armstrong Educational Foundation, which had the rights to this, and negotiated with various record labels and so on, eventually, finally, made a deal with a company called Music Masters. I think you know them. They're mostly into classical, and they're a mail order company. They also have a jazz society branch. This was not an ideal situation. This eventually materialized in 2008. It was not well marketed. It is still available, of course, but you know, it should be much better known. In any case, let me now tell you a little bit about how the Fleischmann's Yeast show came about. Fleischmann's Yeast, of course, was a well-established national radio, weekly radio show, which was initiated right after the stock market crash. Some people claim it was first aired on the 24th of October, 29, which happens to be my birthday, which is Black Thursday, but that's not true. It was about a week later that the Fleischmann's Yeast Show made its debut, and it was headed up by none other than Rudy Vallee. Now, Rudy Vallee and Louis Armstrong may seem like an odd combination, but the fact of the matter is that Rudy, aside from his crooning and so on, also had been a saxophone player. Actually, his name wasn't really Rudy. He adopted that name. His name was Herbert Pryor Vallee, but he adopted the name Rudy for Rudy Wiedorf, who many of you will know was the first great saxophone virtuoso. And he had a feeling for jazz. There is a lovely, he discovered various people. One of them was Alice Faye, Brian Rust's heartthrob, as some of you may know. Alice Faye is heard on a Fleischmann's Yeast Vallee show from 1935 with the Mills Brothers doing a lovely version of Dinah. Absolutely charming. And Rudy frequently had jazz guests. Also, as some of you may know, he wrote the introduction to Louis' first biography, Swing That Music, published in 1936, the first biography of a jazz musician, the first biography of an African-American jazz musician, and another landmark in Louis' career. Not a great book, not as good as Louis' own Satchmo, but interesting. But Vallee's preface is terrific. He really had insight into Louis, especially the singing. So now, what happened in 1937? Rudy Vallee decided he had done the show since 1929. He decided to take some time off. In the 1920s, he had spent quite a bit of time in England. He was a member of not the Savoy Orpheans, but the Savoy Havana Band, which was popular with society in London. And he had made the acquaintance of some of the royal family. As most of you will know, the Prince of Wales, who eventually became Edward VIII and resigned, fortunately, because of his political orientation, and was replaced by his brother, was the Duke of Kent. The Duke of Kent was also a jazz fan and actually especially fond of Ellington. Rudy had made the acquaintance of these royals, and he decided to take some time off and go to England to be present at the coronation of became George VI. He managed to persuade the agency, the advertising agency for the Fleischmann's Yeast Show and Fleischmann's Yeast, which was a product of General Foods, to let Louis Armstrong take over and to create a show which was called Harlem, which was entirely dedicated to black performers and headed by Armstrong and his big band. So, starting on April 9th, 1937, for 13 weeks, Armstrong headed up a national sponsored radio program, which was a first in radio history. There had been, of course, black musicians were heard on radio almost every night. You could hear bands, you know, broadcasting from ballrooms all over the place. The Mills Brothers, who were enormously popular, had some sponsored radio activity, but not a nationally broadcast sponsored program of the magnitude of this. It was broadcast in prime time on Friday nights at 9:30 on NBC. Okay, so now what we're going to do here is first of all, to give you, well, let me say this. The show was scripted, and the only white person who was really involved in this was a man named Octavius Roy Cohn. Does that mean anything to any of you? Okay. Well, Michael knows everything, so I'm not surprised. He was a writer. He was Southern-born, South Carolina, I think, and he was a man of many parts. He wrote detective fiction. One of his heroes was a black detective, but he also wrote a lot of black dialect stuff, and actually was one of the regular contributors of scripts to Amos and Andy show. Now, Amos and Andy was one of the most popular, if not the most popular, radio programs at that time, still in 1937, still enormously popular. There were sort of the Fleischman show included a couple of comedians who were doing the stuff that Cohn was writing. There were also guests on every show. The list of guests include the Mills Brothers. They were probably the most famous. A vocal group called the Southern Airs. Pearl Bailey's brother, Bill, who was a terrific tap dancer. There were other tap dancers. There were other groups that are not terribly well known, mostly vocal. There was Amanda Randolph. There was Cleo Gibson, who created a problem because when she guested on the show, she cut her number short by one chorus. And you know, these were live shows in front of an audience. So this was risky, but Louis managed to rescue that. He was very quick and he was great at this kind of stuff. So he managed to gloss over it. And in any case, this was a landmark in radio history, but as we shall see, it unfortunately didn't lead to any more things like this. Well, I've talked enough. I want to play some music. The opening of every show, of course, was Louis playing his theme song, Sleepy Time Down South. We will hear that opening, followed by various things from, let me say this, okay, six shows survive. There were six shows found at the Armstrong House. There were actually 13 weeks of programming, so obviously a lot has been lost. Of the six shows, I think one was incomplete, the others were complete, I believe. They include all this other stuff, which is not on the CD. But let's hear the opening, and then we're going to hear one of the things that Louis did on the show, which he had recorded before and was to record after. And I picked this because yesterday my good friend Bruce Boyd Rayburn, were you here for Bruce's thing? He focused on Louis Armstrong and You Rascal You. So we're going to hear this Fleischman's version, which is unique and has more trumpet work than Louis usually did on You Rascal You. So, here we go.
Fleischman's Yeast presents Harlem. Fleischman's Yeast bring you another fast and furious program featuring music by Louis Armstrong, the trumpet king of swing, comedy by Eddie Green and G.G. James, with words by Octavus Roy Cohen. And now, the head gate himself, Louis Armstrong and his orchestra.
Yeah, that's number three now, track three. Oh, no, sorry. I made a mistake. Let's go to track three, okay?
In my face, eating up all my stuff meat, trying to bite me in the back with my wife. That's all.
You no good.
Now, I'll be glad when you did.
You're after you.
I'll be glad when you did. You're after you. I brought you into my home.
You wouldn't leave my wife alone.
I'll be glad. I'll be glad when you did.
You're after you.
I'll be tickled to death when you leave this with your dog. Boy, I took it for my friend, and the way you bit in the back was a sin.
Oh, you dog.
You're after you. I'll be glad when you're dead.
You're after you.
Boy, when you lay in 6 feet deep, no more fried chicken when you eat. I know that'll break your heart, Watergator. My wife thinks you so hot, eh?
In tremendous form here, and the amazing thing is that of the surviving shows, there isn't one where he is not in top form. And this was quite an achievement, because as I will tell you after I ask Doug a few questions, it wasn't always a bed of roses the way these shows had to be done. Doug, when you first encountered these things, I remember especially on Rascal, there was a very tricky, there was a repeat groove that you had to work on. How did you find this stuff?
Well, I would say the discs, if you had a scale from 1 to 10, these were in general somewhere around 5. There were some bad scratches and areas where there are skips, and but, you know, every engineer knows how to get around that. You just struggle with it, play the record backwards sometimes, or at slow speed, or so there were a couple bad scratches, but getting the pitch corrected was a big job, because the two cutters were not running at the same speed, and some of the splices had to be right in the middle of some of Louis' notes. So, and this job had been worked on by other engineers. Jack Towers had made analog transfers years ago, and I could have used his tapes, but I decided to do the whole job digitally. And Seth Winner had been hired to make transfers of all the discs, and I had his CDs, which were, of course, 16-bit 44-1, and I decided since I was going to do this job, I would just do the whole thing myself. So I started from scratch. And but the pitch was a real killer, and I don't know how all other engineers correct pitch. I have a way of doing it that I think is extremely accurate, and I don't use a pitch pipe, and although I have a set of chromatic tuning forks, I don't use them either. I do it in the computer, and it's probably better if you do it at the time you're making the transfer, because I have to use digital signal processing in order to correct pitch. But I can do it. I mean, you heard Louis hit those high notes, and I mean, it's just like a glockenspiel. You know, you can find a section of each of those notes where it's just like a sine wave, and I'll take a section of that and loop it so that it plays over and over again. I can then play a note on my keyboard in the computer, raise and lower the music until that I can just get it exactly the same there. You don't hear any beats. And once I've done that, I can then shift the entire file, the needed up or down, and then splice the pieces together. There was another engineer who had worked on this. Maybe I shouldn't mention his name.
Yeah, let him remain nameless, but he didn't know what to do.
Yeah, well, he was mostly into classical music, someone that music masters had used before. And, in fact, I got a panicky phone call from him because he was afraid that if they paid me, they wouldn't pay him. I don't know if he ever got paid. I didn't.
He did.
He did, okay. But yeah, that was a big job. The other thing I might mention is that there is a difference, of course, between archival work and restoration for commercial release. And what the introduction that you heard is actually the combination of two different programs, because there was a slight, Dan heard it. It didn't bother me, but Dan said, well, there's a slight fluff in there. So I spliced in a section of that introduction from another program completely. And I remember that the Mills brothers appeared twice, but he only played with them once in the piece we used. But in the introduction, I thought it was nice to be able to put the two introductions together because it was more interesting. So it's fake, but I defy you to hear where the splice is. But I wanted to get as much. It's entertainment. I wanted to get as much of the entertainment value as possible. So this is not an archival job. This is a production number. The sound, these lacquers were obviously recorded with no pre-emphasis. They sounded really quite dull. And I'm sure that, you know, there was one mic for the whole band and Louis, and it was a dynamic mic. It had very little in terms of highs. And so I had to EQ. Obviously, I felt it was incumbent upon me to EQ this because otherwise, it really sounded pretty dull. And of course, you know, how do we know what should be done? You know, we have to use our ears. And of course, it sounds different on these speakers than it does in my studio on my speakers. So there's no correct answer to this, as far as I'm concerned. You have to use your ears. You try to imagine what it sounded like in the room. But with one microphone, with Louis playing directly into the mic, and he was playing trumpet then, not cornet.
No cornet.
And the trumpet is piercing. And so when he plays directly into the mic, the band basically is in New Jersey. you know. I mean, you can never hear the piano. There is a piano there, but you know, it's just kind of a mushy sound in the background, but the bass, you know, I made sure that I didn't lose the bass, but I had to boost. There's a lot of EQ on here. I mean, I confess, if you saw the EQ curve I used, you would say, oh, no, you can't do that. But I just had to please myself. There's no nothing else you can do.
Well, you didn't only please yourself. You certainly pleased me, and I think you pleased everybody who hears these things.
Well, we're both losing
our
hearing.
Did a wonderful job.
So
but, yeah, well, since Doug mentioned the band, you know, I want to say a few words about that. First of all, there was a New Orleans contingent in the band at the time. There was Albert Nicholas, the great clarinetist, who is not well featured on Louis' Decca recordings of the time. As a matter of fact, there's only one Nicholas solo in all the Deccas. But here, he is quite well represented. There was also, you mentioned bass, and the bass is there because it's Pops Foster. And then his teammate in the rhythm section was Paul Barberin, whose work with Louis' big band is somewhat overshadowed by the man who followed him, the big Sid Catlett, who was probably, in my opinion, I think, the greatest jazz drummer ever. Some beboppers will fight with me about that, but even they, Max Roach thought that Sid Catlett was the next to God. So anyway, Paul is a little overshadowed by that, but he was excellent, and he has a real New Orleans feel. So that was part of it. Louis' big bands have been treated badly by critics, mostly because, and that brings up something that I wanted to mention about, about the attitude towards Louis in the 1930s among critics. The early generation of jazz writers all adored what they called the parent style of New Orleans. They accepted Louis, of course, how could they not? But to them, Louis' greatest period was the Hot Five, Hot Seven, and once he got into working with big bands and playing pop tunes, well, you know, that was a decline. If you really want to read about all that, it is a wonderful book by Bruce Rayburn called New Orleans Style and the Writing of American Jazz History. It's highly recommended, and it deals with all that, including his business with the Moldy Figs, which was touched upon in the excellent overview of the Record Changer that we had yesterday, in which you know, Leonard Feather was nailed to the wall. But let me say this about Leonard. Leonard was very friendly with Louis Armstrong. They had a long relationship, which also included a great deal of correspondence. Leonard left the Institute of Jazz Studies. I shouldn't say left, because he was still alive when he gave us a wonderful chunk of correspondence with jazz musicians, including a whole bunch of letters from Louis, who at the time, this is in the late 30s and early 40s, was using yellow stationery that had Satchmo in green on top. And he, of course, always traveled with a typewriter. He loved to write letters. And the typewriter at the time had green ribbon. So you get this green on the yellow paper. It's a thing of beauty, actually. One of the letters to Leonard Feather is 13 single-spaced pages. But the reason why I bring it up here is that one of the letters is a response to a question by Leonard at the time from late 1941. How he arrived at this figure, I don't know, but he's asking Louis about the most important things in his 25 years in music, which is, you know, makes it a little early, but it's okay. And Louis responded to this as follows. He says, "As far as the most important events in jazz during my 25 years, well, The first one was when Pops, meaning Joe Glazer, booked me for my first commercial playing over the NBC, the Fleischmann's Yeast. So that was how Louis felt about that 4 years after the fact, that this was really one of the highlights in his career up to that point. And it remains a landmark in the history of radio, which is a quite fascinating history. Let us go again to something. Among the things that Louis recorded, let me say this about that also, as Richard Nixon used to say. Let me say this about that. As Doug pointed out, you know, the room ambiance is somewhat of a problem. These things were not broadcast from one place. They were broadcast wherever Louis happened to be at the time of the broadcast. Some of them are from the Paramount Theater in New York City, where actually he had broken early 1937, he broke Benny Goodman's famous attendance record at the Paramount. And one of the few references, there are surprisingly few references in the jazz press to the Fleischmann shows, but there is one, the first one, in Downbeat from the May, Downbeat was a monthly then, May 1937 issue. There is a photo of Louis. There's a little headline that says Satchel Mount slays them, and it says Louis broke Benny Goodman's record at the Paramount Theater the first 5 days and just signed for one of the largest commercials, the Fleischmann's Yeast program. He is truly a horn of plenty. Among the things, and by the way, the band is in very good shape, and some of these things are instrumentals featuring the band, and it really sounds much better than it does on most of the commercial recordings, perhaps because, you know, they were really up for this. And also, a number of pieces were done that he never recorded commercially. But here I want to play for you a beautiful version of a tune that was very important in Louis' career. It was from the film Pennies from Heaven, an independent production by Bing Crosby. It was released by Columbia Pictures, but it was Bing's movie, and Bing really featured Louis. It was the first feature film he'd made short in which he was seen, and he had what he was very proud of. He had an acting role as well as performing. Of course, the number he did in the film was The Skeleton in the Closet, which is terrific. But the theme there was Pennies from Heaven. There was a 12-inch Decca recording of Pennies from Heaven and a couple of other songs, Skeleton in the Closet, and with Francis Langford, Bing, and Louis. But he didn't play on Pennies from Heaven. He just sang it. In fact, he does not play Pennies from Heaven in his recorded legacy until the famous Town Hall concert in 1947, where he does a beautiful version of it. But here he does Pennies, and it's one of the highlights, I think, of the Fleischmann's material, and that is track 6.
Every time it rains, it rains. When it's from heaven, well, don't you know each cloud contains? When it's from heaven, like your fortune's falling all over town. Be sure that your umbrella is well stuck down. Trade them for a package of sunshine and flowers. If you want the things you love, you must have showers every night or day. And when you hear the thunder, don't run under the tree. There'll be plenty from heaven for you and me. This is the tune that Mr. Bing Crosby made famous. Swing it, boys.
A marvelous solo he plays there. And he does some stuff that makes you think of what Miles Davis said about Louis. He said, can't play anything on the horn that Louis hasn't played already. And I mean even modern. And that's proof right there. I just want to say briefly something about the circumstances surrounding the the broadcast of these shows. Because of Pennies from Heaven, Louis was in demand in Hollywood, and he appeared in a number of feature films in the 1930s, including one called Going Places, in which the second male lead is none other than Ronald Reagan. However, the one that was involved with the Fleischmanns here was a thing called Artists and Models, starring Jack Benny, in which Louis does a number with Martha Ray, who is lightly blacked up, and this created a big stir. The number was public melody number one, and in which Louis is actually the head of a bunch of gangsters using the trumpet as a kind of machine gun. Anyway, this masterpiece was filmed in Hollywood during the Fleischmanns period. And what happened there was as follows. Louis had signed the contract that he had to be available for the broadcast, no matter what. So here, after he did the May 21st broadcast in Chicago, he had to fly to Los Angeles, and he had to be back in New York, where the next show was emanating from, on the 28th of May. So here's what happened. He was booked to open at the Apollo in New York on the 27th, the day before the show. He left Chicago on the May 21st. He arrived in L.A. on May 22nd at 2 p.m. His flight delayed more than 5 hours due to a sandstorm in Kansas. So things haven't changed very much, have they? So there he was, and he then left California at 9:15 a.m. on the 26th, arriving in New York at 8 the next morning after a stopover in Pittsburgh. And then if you check him out on the May 28th show, you know, he's in wonderful form, as always. But this is, you know, in those days, flying coast to coast was not exactly something that people did, you know, like they do today. This was a major achievement for Louis Armstrong. It was highly praised in the black press, except for the fact that in the Amsterdam News, which was probably the most left-leaning of the major black papers, a young man named Adam Clayton Powell took objection to the nature of the show, you know, but I have said that there were certain overtones of, you know, kind of Amos and Andy comedy and so on. And he even said that the show should be boycotted. But we all know what happened to Adam Clayton Powell later on, so let him rest in peace. Anyway, the show, the 13 weeks were a big success. When Rudy Vallee came back and did his first, redid his, you know, return to the show, it was a very nice gesture on his part to have Louis as his guest on that first show. He continued with Fleischmann's until 1939, while he didn't have very much else to do with jazz history, he did manage a group, an R&B group that some of you may know, Steve Gibson and the Red Caps. Very good band, actually recorded quite a bit. Rudy had his finger on various things. He was, by the way, a notorious cheapskate. I was told by someone who visited him at his pretty fancy home in Hollywood that when you wanted to make a phone call, you were directed to the garage in which he had installed a payphone. However, I would say, bless Rudy Vallee for doing this for Louis Armstrong and for African-American performers and music on radio. Unfortunately, there was no follow-up to this. As many of you will know, even more than a decade later, Nat King Cole had a show on television that ran for just a year, couldn't find a sponsor. So things didn't change very much, but this remains a landmark in Louis' career, in the history of radio in this country. And thanks to Doug Pomeroy, we have this in excellent sound, and I'm not pushing this. I'm not getting any royalties for this. I did the notes. But do listen. It's wonderful stuff. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to have to move forward. Dan will be available questions that you might have, but we need to move into the next presentation because we are running a little bit behind time here. So thank you very much, gentlemen.